All right, before we get started with today's show, I want to share something you might find interesting. Yesterday, Mina Kimes chatted with Ravens reporter Jameson Hensley on ESPN Daily about how Ravens opponents prepare for facing Lamar Jackson. They hire impersonators. Okay, good luck with that. Download and subscribe to ESPN Daily right now and the Right Time podcast wherever you get your podcasts. 66% of men lose their hair by age 35, like me, and it's a big problem. So why do guys sit there and do nothing about it when they can turn to medicine and science? Once you've noticed thinning hair, it's probably too late. But there's a solution, and it's for Hims.com. It's a one-stop shop for hair loss, skin care, and other wellness supplements for men. Hims is helping guys be the best version of themselves with licensed physicians and FDA-approved products to help treat their hair loss. Prescription solutions backed by science. Now, Hims is created by a guy who knows some men's health conversations are easier online than in person. So no more awkward in-person doctor's visits, no more long pharmacy lines. For Hims connects you to real doctors online. It can save you hours, completely confidential and discreet. You'll answer a few quick questions. The doctor will review you. And if they determine it's right for you, can prescribe you medication to treat your hair loss that is shipped directly to your door. Dive into 2020 hair first. Right now, my listeners can get started with their first month free. Go to forhims.com/Bomani. That's forhims.com/Bomani. Prescription requires an online consultation with a physician who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Offer valid only if prescribed. 3-month minimum subscription. Additional restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information. Remember, that's forhims.com/Bomani. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening. Wherever you get your podcast, rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are, in fact, a hater. It is that time of week where we do interviews. Joining me, a man with a watch on that looks very similar to my own. Look at it. It's the same model.
Oh, is it? I got some gold in mine. Huh?
Yeah, I got some diamonds.
Man, you get paid better than
Dominique, don't you eat.
I mean, it's a fact. You got a TV show, podcast. You get paid better than me.
What you walk in with? Because I know what I walked in
with. I'm just saying, I stated something that was a fact. It is a fact that you currently, your salary is higher than mine, so your watch should have diamonds and mine should not.
Look, I got here, it was me and my lonesome. I remember the little sound. I know the signing bonus I got to buy this watch. I know the signing bonus you got.
Oh yeah, it's public. I did not buy this watch. My father-in-law
even better
bought it for me.
Even better. You know people who will buy you a watch like that.
Yep.
I don't. I don't know. No, I can't imagine you gonna buy me a Rolex.
Maybe you should get married.
Let me tell you something. Simply getting married isn't going to do the job. I got engaged once, and let me tell you what none of them was about to buy me. No damn Rolex.
Well, I made a good choice.
Good call. Welcome. Good to see you.
You too, man. Always fun.
Yeah, man. So,
I feel like the expectations are high for this podcast because, like, we're batting pretty high percentage. I feel like whenever I'm on here, it's flames, so.
No disrespect, but they always high when I show up. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I'm saying that, yeah, relative to your normal height.
Oh, okay.
I would argue that adding me.
Got you.
Is
got
a boost,
you.
Whereas
got
adding you. Other people might just keep it neutral.
Got you.
Nobody brings
got
it down.
Got you. So rather than the usual 7-point favorite, I'm now a 10-point favorite.
That's all I'm saying.
All
it
right.
May not matter to anybody but the odds makers, but it matters to me.
You know what? I'm with that. I got a question for you. You think they would hire either of us to be an NFL coach?
Nah. Hell no.
Hold on. I saw a quick clip of this on Get Up. I need you to tell me how it went when somebody asked about, you said Kellen Moore would be a head coach. And I think some people were surprised you said that. You were like, yeah, he's offensive coordinator and he's white. How'd that go over?
I mean, they are no longer surprised by me. So I say stuff on TV all the time that catches people off guard, but I think it only catches the viewers off guard because Greenberg and Laura and all them, they are accustomed to it and they know I'm going there when given the opportunity.
Man, every day having me yesterday, I was at the crib and I got a text from a man, Stosh, and he's like, hey, Sarah wants to know if you can come on to talk about the Rooney Rule. And I'm like, all right, cool. I can do that. It's Sarah and Phil Yates. By the time it got going, man, I was getting cracking, right?
Yeah.
Right. I was getting going. You know, they were understandably just like, you know, so what's, you know, what are we doing with the problem? They were looking for some level of analysis, man. And I was just in a place. You know what I'm saying? And so I'm just, you know, I got some jokes.
Yeah.
I got a little anger, but by the end, I was railing, man. And right. They're just like, yeah, so what can we do? It's like every year we just ask about this, da, da, da. And I think what our solution is, we got to start shaming people.
Yeah.
It's the only thing we can do because of all the times we talk about this, and all the, I don't know, you know, the Rooney Rule is a sham, which I think is a bit of a complex discussion for people to have, and all these different things that people talk about. They're like, what can we do? And then they just wind up like resigned mm-hmm. to the idea that the owners aren't going to do anything about this. I'm like, no, we can get out here and we can shame them.
Yeah. I think we should. And I mean, I think so also on Get Up, we talked about it a lot in the first hour and it did so well. They brought it back in the second hour, but I think they ran out of questions to ask. So then they threw at me. So how do you fix it? And I'm on the spot, but I actually have come up with an idea that I like. I like so much that I said it on First Take. And I think that they should be required to put in writing. The owners should be required to put in writing all the people that they bring in for interviews. You must put in writing your rationale for bringing them in for the interview. And then when you decide to hire somebody, you must put in writing the reason why you decided to hire them. And you must put in writing the people that you interviewed, the reasons why you did not decide to hire them. Because I think that my theory is that it's unconscious bias leaking in to make these decisions. And I say unconscious bias, frankly, because it makes white people comfortable.
Yes.
It could be conscious bias. I don't care. The final result is that the numbers are embarrassing. So essentially, if you use the sports analogy, the final score, you're losing as a league. And I say you put that in there because, and you force them to put in writing the reasons for their decisions every step of the way, is it forces them to come to grips with whatever biases that cause them to make the decision. So I think that I hate keep picking on David Tepper, but he gave me the quote that sets up exactly what's happening in all these situations. He said, and I quote, that in talking about Matt Rhule, the guy he hired, he dresses like bleep, like me. He reminds me of myself. Like, he essentially said what we all know to be true is that you're going to kind of give some sort of, you're going to have a feeling. And I think that's a lot of times they're like, well, all these guys are kind of similar, whatever. Maybe this guy's good at that. Maybe this guy's that. But like, I got a feeling about this guy. You know what that feeling is? It's unconscious bias. And so like, when we do this, when you write it down, you can't write on a piece of paper or type it up on a memo on your letterhead and publish it. I mean, all these guys was good, but I had a feeling about this guy. You would embarrass yourself. It would require you to say like, all right, for the Giants who interviewed Eric Bieniemy, who is obviously on paper more qualified than Joe Judge. And I hate that this situation forces us to talk about these specific coaches, but we kind of have to because that's what makes it so embarrassing and stark. And that's what makes the quote that we all know as black people, that all our parents said to us, you got to be twice as good. That's what makes it so starkly apparently clear in the NFL is when you have guys like Matt LaFleur. One interview, got hired. Joe Judge, one interview, no coordinating experience, got hired. Cliff Kingsbury, college failure, got a head coaching job in the NFL. That's what makes that quote stand out. And so when you are forced to account for those decisions, a lot of people, I'm sorry, I'm rambling, but I'm just coming on First Take, so I'm hot. A lot of people will throw this in your face and say, like, I can defend that hire. And I think the fact of the matter is you probably can defend all of those hires, which is why I'm asking you to also defend why you did not hire somebody. And it's unfortunate because a lot of people will sigh, and we talk about this often. A lot of people find themselves, fans that is, relating to the owners and siding with them and saying something akin to, it's their business. You can't tell them who to hire. Put that aside. That's foolishness on its face to start with, but it is made extra stupid by the fact that the NFL is essentially a legal cartel. They own a monopoly. We have allowed them to do that. So no, their success and the league's success is not only because they're hardworking, smart businessmen. It's because we've afforded them some level of advantage. And also, these owners who own these teams, while they've created some great man theory of themselves, and David Tepper said, like, I got everything I got because I worked hard. Like, I guarantee you can go through his life and find many examples of things where it was luck or it was good fortune, and they don't account for that. They just think that the reason why I'm not hiring or black coaches aren't having the success that they need, or we're not hiring black coaches because they're not working hard enough. And that stresses me out. So I know I'm all over the place, but the final point I'll make, and I reiterate the fact that I don't think it's unfair to ask them to account for the decisions they make.
No.
And I don't think it's unfair to present that to us. I think that would be fair of a public business or any public or private business that does not exist as a monopoly, as a cartel. But they actually, our federal government gives them the ability to exist as a legal cartel. So it's not outlandish for us to say, hey, why don't you tell us why you did what you did?
Well, here's what I wonder, right? And for people who don't know this, the Rooney Rule did not come about because was it Dan Rooney at the time, whichever Rooney it was, just popped up and said, we got a problem and we need to fix it. No, it popped up because Johnny Cochran said, we're going to sue your pants off.
That's a good point.
Behind this, right? And then they're like, wait a minute. Now that dude got OJ off. He's a magician. You know what I'm saying? And so they're like, all right, cool. So let's come up with something. And then they wound up coming up with something. What I want to know is what would have come up in discovery that made them decide that they were going to do this basically at the threat of the lawsuit. Like, what were they afraid was going to bubble up to the surface? And the thing is, this is ebbed and flowed at points. You'll have some years where you look up and it's like, oh, wow, seven black dudes coaching the league. You look up at a point where it is now, and it's three of them, right? Like, so there's never like a consistent place that we're in doing this. However, the part that hasn't changed is the base of the ownership class, right? And in fact, it's changing a little bit now because it's bringing these hedge fund guys in there, but go look at their other jobs and see who it is that they hire over there to do these things. And there's a wave, like pretty much this year, I don't know what the wave is this year, but last year the wave was Sean McVay. Right. I said that Sean McVay could solve this whole thing by hiring a squad full of black dudes, right? And then all of a sudden we fix this because they all knew Sean McVay. And then I was like, damn, did Sean McVay hire any black dudes? Like, you know, no shade to him. I'm just saying, because everybody else getting a job, why is this happening? What's the wave now? Because the wave was McVay. The wave always changes, but the wave always seems to move in a direction where there are no black and brown people. No matter what the new wave happens to be, it moves away from that. And so now the wave is offensive coordinators.
Right.
Black dudes can't get those jobs.
Yeah, and it's in part because of the history of the quarterback position. And the history, it's like it's the ingrained belief that black people are somehow inferior intellectually. And it's also, and you see that in other positions where it's ingrained belief that white people are inferior athletically. Like, that's why you don't get no white corners. I guarantee you, half of the slot receivers that we see in the league could make a lot more money
playing
corner. But somewhere along the line, their coach looked at it and was like, you know what you look like? You look like a slot receiver.
Right.
Can you catch? Get on over there. Shake it around a little bit. Like, it's the same skill set is required of that. And the same thing is true of running back. Like, Christian McCaffrey, we enjoy Christian McCaffrey, and Christian McCaffrey gets a lot of that Eminem love. Because, like, Christian, just like Eminem, Christian McCaffrey is real.
You're right.
He is nasty. But also, it helps that you are a little novel in that place. So, I think the only reason why no one cares about that is because they're not a disenfranchised group, like in general. But it's true that our unconscious bias lead us in a way that I think cuts out white people in some ways.
But you know why people don't trip on that when it happens, though? Because the same people that's telling black folks that they can't be coaches are the same people telling white dudes that they can't be corners. It's still white dudes. Like, that's the part. Every time somebody comes to me, well, what about these white, we need more white running backs. We'll go talk to these white folks and ask them if they're going to do something about it. Dustin Fox, he played corner at Ohio State. And he's talked about this on Twitter before.
He was in my draft. Somehow he got drafted ahead of me, so.
Oh, word.
I mean.
He a pioneer.
I know. He a white corner.
You a disappointment.
I know. And the reason why I was shocked was like, they moving him into safety immediately. And I guarantee you, ASAP. Dustin, he was a cool dude. I remember him from the East-West Shrine game. Good dude. But I was joking with him, like, what you doing in these one-on-one drills, man? You know you getting moved to safety? They not going to keep you at corner, white man?
But you know what he talked about, though? He said, though, the guys that were trying to, that thought he could play corner, the two names that jump out to me, Mike Tomlin and Mel Tucker. He said, right, that's what I'm saying. It was the black dudes that thought he could play corner. Yeah. It was the white dudes that were trying to move him off and to put him off into another situation. That's why, like, the unconscious bias thing is tricky for me, because I feel like we're basically doing that because everybody afraid of hurting some white folks' feelings. Yeah. So we got to tell white folks, hey, I don't think you're doing this on purpose.
Yeah.
Just at no point in your life did you ever look up or look around and realize the world that you had created, in spite of the fact we have this conversation every year. It's kind of like when we talk about newspaper headlines and when they make those same mistakes and they pull those same pictures and they put the black person's mugshot in a place where they don't necessarily put the white person's mugshot, all that stuff. We talk about that stuff every single year, and then we tell people, well, I know it's not your fault. You don't really mean nothing by it. At some point, you got to start meaning something on the other side. And that's where the NFL gets me. If you really bought it, if this is something, or diversity involves values that you wish to reflect, then when you gonna do it?
Yeah.
What you gonna, like, what are you going to do? Cause in the end, guess who wins? The teams.
Yeah.
If the teams go find good coaches, because finding a good coach is really difficult. These are the only people in the world you can think of. It's the same thing with quarterback, though they're getting a little bit better. Yeah. You acknowledge that it's hard to find somebody who can do this job, and so you then go out of your way to look at fewer people. How stupid is that?
To limit the pool. Yeah, it's pretty stupid. But I think that the reason why, and I said this verbatim on First Take, and that might be the reason why I'm coming in here hot, because I'm just walking off the First Take set. But I said clearly, I'm saying unconscious bias because it makes white people comfortable, but it may be conscious. But to be frank with you, I don't care. We cover sports, and as many of us try to cover the nuances and the intricacies of what actually happens in a game, it don't matter. The final score is the final score. If you didn't win the Super Bowl, your season was a failure. If you lost this game, you lost. Like, it don't matter why. So, like, I feel the same way. Like, the final score is the final score, NFL. And I think as much as I can be critical of Roger Goodell for a ton of different things, like, I think he genuinely wants to change this and has generally put forth efforts to change this, but he can't make them hire who he wants them to hire. He can't change. So I got into this with Stephen A, and Stephen A and I disagree often on issues of race around this spot. It's like we agree essentially with the destination, but how to get there. And Stephen A made the argument essentially that the players of today and the Players Association should put pressure on the league to change this because they have benefited from other players sacrificing for them to get to this point. And I understand and support that. It's like you must carry this on. But who has benefited more through the structure of this country and this league specifically than these billionaire white owners? Like, rather than talk about the people or put the pressure, and Stephen A, to his credit, said he just would say that both, like, the players should put pressure and the owners should take responsibility. But I would absolve any obligation or responsibility from the players who are just trying to make some money, who are just trying to, and I know it sounds like trite almost, but like, most of the guys in the league are going to leave the league with no useful experience to get another job. And maybe if they're lucky, a couple $100,000 in the bank and they have to start another career. And I know that sounds like a lot of money, but that's not a ton of money if you were in college, not taking a major that allowed you to play football. If the years where you were supposed to be doing internships, you was playing football. So all that aside, I don't think it's their responsibility. I think it's the responsibilities of the benefactors or the people who benefited from this program. From the system as it's currently constructed, it's their responsibility to write it. And it's not the responsibility of the people who are suffering as a result.
Yeah, it's like, we got to fix this too.
Yeah.
Like
that's
the thing I resent is anytime I get called on these shows and they're like, well, what can we do to fix it? Why are you asking me?
Yeah.
Like why am I the worst? I need to start doing that. If I had a radio show now, anytime something came up, I'm going to start asking any white person that come up, hey, man. What you think can fix? You know these white folks better than I do. What do you think can fix this? What do you think can remedy this? Because it is, no.
It stressed me out, like during the whole Kaepernick thing where we were going around as media, when I say we, and asking all the black players, like, so are you going to kneel? How do you feel about Kaepernick? Do you feel an obligation? Like, I understand why you asked that, but shouldn't it be the people who have benefited from this that we ask? Like, hey, you may not be aware of this, but you have benefited a great deal from this system. So, like, what are you going to do to rectify it since you have all of this goodwill, essentially, from the structure?
And what we are proposing will benefit them.
Yeah.
All we're saying is, hey, you guys think you might want to look at some more people? Right?
The point that Swagoo made towards the end of the segment that I thought resonated with me is they don't think it's a problem. They making $25 billion a year. They like, I don't care. Like, are we still getting money? And I guess that's the argument in Stephen A's favor is as fans or whatever, we must make them feel this.
I will say this though. Counterpoint. No coach is getting fired because of the profit margin.
Yeah,
right.
Or hired. Yeah.
Right. But coaches get fired all the time, and it's not because of the profit margin. They get fired because they're not winning. So they do care about winning. I can then only assume that they think that somehow there's a negative correlation between having a black coach and winning. Even though, this is a fun fact for you about the Johnny Cochran thing. I mentioned this on the radio yesterday. I went to the Economist conference in 2003, right? The ASSA, I forget what it stands for, but I was there. And there was a presentation that was made by a gentleman. I think it was a gentleman that made it. Anyway, he was working with Cochran on that suit. I didn't realize at the time what everything was that was going on, but he was there. And at that time, there had been all of five black head coaches in the modern era.
In the history.
In the history, right? There had been five. With those five, they found a statistically significant correlation between having a black coach and winning, right? Now, is that because black coaches are naturally better? No, it's because it's so damn hard to get a job as a black coach that you got to be the man in order to get it.
Twice as hard. We've all heard that growing
up. Exactly. There was your
twice as good.
Right. There was your statistical proof of it. It was right there directly in front, right? That's what it took in order for us to get jobs. And once you got them, but even still get run off pronto, like the Caldwell situation is the trickiest one. Cause what people don't talk about nearly enough is the fact that he got fired in Indianapolis, right? Like, we talk about, you know, the thing that happened in Detroit, which is its own problem, 3 out of 4 years winning with the Lions, and they said 9 wins wasn't enough to fire him. The next dude won has nine wins in 2 games, and he come to work dressed like he don't give a f***, and he still got a job, right? Okay, cool. Caldwell, that team could have gone undefeated in 2009, but they pulled the starters late, and they wound up going 14-2. They went to the playoffs the next year. The year after, Peyton Manning gets hurt. They go 2-14, but I remember that team. They played hard all the way to the end, to the point where, by the way, in weeks 15 and 16, I believe it was, they beat a 9-win team and they beat a 10-win team, right? That's how they closed out that year on, a team that up to that point had not won any games. That's a man who obviously did a good job coaching, to me, right? Because that team wasn't built to win without no Peyton Manning, right? They were out there with Dan Orlovsky, shout out, Curtis Painter, and Kerry Collins, who they picked up off the street because he used to play for Caldwell at Penn State.
Right.
That's what they
and
did.
They knew that Andrew Luck was coming up.
Right.
They was ready to get Andrew Luck, but Caldwell almost messed it up because he's a good coach.
Right, but this is the thing about that. The reason they hired Caldwell, or the big thing he did like to get known, was he got to Indianapolis and fixed Peyton Manning. That was the big thing. People forget this. Peyton Manning, year four, was out there looking bad, bad. And Peyton Manning will tell anybody how good Jim Caldwell was for him. Now you're bringing in the young quarterback, right? You're bringing him in. And who do you hire to be the head coach? Chuck Pagano.
Yeah, right.
Now, it's very interesting that all these years and all this time that we hear about what you got to have is a coach that can work with the young quarterback. And you've been hearing that way back to then. That's not a new thing. And you had the guy who was built to work with the young quarterback. And what did you say instead?
Right.
Nope. I'll go get the defensive guy. Now, you tell me, if Pagano had that job and had that same setup,
The things wouldn't play out the same. And, like, Jim Caldwell is a name that is interesting because he stepped away from his job with the Dolphins. But that's a name – Jim Caldwell is a name that I bring up often when they're talking about who's the head coach you could hire because of the success that he had in that situation. I'm going to steal all that stuff that you just gave me about him saving Peyton Manning. I'm going to go back and read up on it and make sure that I'm sharp on it. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a shout-out. I always do when I steal stuff from you. But that's a good point. Like, we're all looking – quarterback whisperer is, like, the code word that we've used – that many people have used to box out some black people. But you know what? We got a pretty good quarterback whisperer. And like Adam Gase has gotten 2 jobs off the strength of his quarterback whispering to some of the same people, and his whispering ain't that quiet.
His whispering was the top of his game, Peyton Manning.
Who was fixed by Jim Caldwell.
Right? Like, it's bananas that it ends up that way. And then we have the same conversation every year. And I look at our colleagues in this, and they're the ones that I want to get on. Because when NFL Insider, insert name here, puts out a report, and then they give the list of guys who are going to be interviewed, and it's all white dudes, now's the time for you to mention they have not interviewed a non-white candidate for this job. Don't refer to him as a Rooney Rule interview. Right. Simply say they have not interviewed a non-white candidate for this job. And then go from there. But when you start calling it, well, they have to do a Rooney Rule interview, now we are enabling this idea that all it is a box to check. And we act like it's okay for them to just do that, when in reality, we should be out here shaming these fools. Yeah. And I don't even know how exactly you go about shaming them, but shaming them is the thing that's the only thing that has any potential to work. And it's the one thing that the media that works around this has not really tried. Like, every now and then, you know, one of us, you know, Jim Trotter get out here, write something, be a thing on the undefeated, you know. But the guys that really got the sway in this, they ain't saying nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I credit Stephen A. for, because he goes at it aggressively whenever something like this comes up. He says something about it, and he did yesterday pretty aggressively. But I think that your point about shaming him, the reason why that may be the only route, and I think part of them being shamed is what I'm saying, is you have to put in writing your rationale, because then we can pick that apart. They don't have to talk. Normally, they can hide in the background. Most of these owners, like – I really would find it interesting to explain the Cliff Kingsbury hire from last year. I think there's an easier way to explain that, but put it in writing. I need to know why. I need to know why you didn't hire Eric Bieniemy or why you didn't hire Jim Caldwell or somebody like that or Marvin Lewis or something. And I don't know a whole ton of candidates because y'all won't hire them. But, I mean, y'all won't interview them. So I think that's important. But I think you brought up your history as an economist. And I think that's interesting because this is something that if they existed in a free market, this is why I think the antitrust protection matters. Because if they existed in a free market and they made the decision to limit their selection pool, they would pay for it, I think, on Sundays and pay for it in whether their business could even stay afloat or not. But now there is no penalty for stinking. If you stink, you know what? You still make a whole bunch of money and you don't get relegated. You're not subject to the same competitive dynamics that any other company would be subject to. Yep. And I think that diversity would give you an advantage. You see it in college, frankly. You see the creativity of the offenses in college because it is slightly closer to a free market. The decision making and hiring there is not. And that is for a number of different reasons. You know college very well. You could explain those better than me. But I think that's why antitrust matters. That's why that protection matters, because the only reason why you aren't paying for this in the way that I think you probably would is because you're protected.
And I also think, and this is something you and I have talked about a lot, like part of why I'm careful about what I say about this Joe Judge dude, in part because I don't know anything about him, right? I'm not in a place to – he does seem to have that same New England Patriots, we don't care how we look at work thing. And I got a big problem with that, man. Show some pride. You know, act like you care. Act like you care a little bit. Belichick at least shave before the game. You know what I'm saying? Like, act like somebody going to be watching you. But I don't mind the fact that he hasn't coordinated an offense or anything like that, because I have no reason to believe that makes you a better coach. Right? You and I talked about this all the time, that this is managing people, being detail-oriented, like organization, I think, from what I've seen, is the most important thing.
I've heard that he's meticulous.
Yeah.
Some of his college players who played while he was the special teams analyst in college said that he was meticulous. But, I mean, I've written about this. That there's nothing about coordinating that prepares you to be a head coach. Like, it's not the same job. It's an entirely different job. So one of the best head coaches I played for was John Harbaugh, who was a special teams coach. And I think there's something to be said for the job of special teams coach is to work with the entire team and, frankly, get guys motivated to do jobs that they don't want to do. So I think that actually, you could argue that is good preparatory work for being a head coach.
Right. And plus, you, guy who runs offense, you worry about calling plays. You, guy who runs defense, you worry
about
calling plays.
That's why we pay you.
Right. Me, suddenly I have all this free time to do other stuff. Like, you're not going to convince me that a head coach calling plays does not have a deleterious effect on other things that go on. Because obviously there are guys out here who don't call the plays. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why they don't. It's other stuff for you to be out here doing.
Your time is finite, and there is – other people can call the plays. Other people can design the defense and call the plays. No one has the same influence on a team culture. And the culture, in my mind, is something that can create sustained success. Building relationships and team culture and talking to the media, because talking to the media is also how you communicate with your players many times. Like, that is so important. Those are the things that they should be focusing on. And in-game decisions, like where you should be having the whole game in your mind, not the next play as a head coach, because you need to be the one who says, in this situation, it's 3rd and 6. We're going to go for it if you don't get it. And then you tell your offensive coordinator that, and it changes his decision because you're thinking about the whole picture. And those are the things that you're not thinking about and you're not prepared for, and time management. Those things, Andy Reid is one of the best coaches of all time. He gets dinged for time management. And I don't think that it is not connected to the fact that his awesome brain is focused on offensive stuff all the time.
That's fair. By the way, thinking about all these coaches who gets jobs and who doesn't. How much you think Raheem Morris got to hate Josh McDaniels? Are they kind of like low-key the same dude?
Yeah.
You know, like, Raheem got that job super young.
Right.
Because the guys in Tampa believed they had a star. Like, they saw it in him, and they made him a coach. It might have been a little bit too early. He had that one 10-win season. Then I remember he came out the next year, and he was doing interviews explaining how he was from the hood and the players were from the hood, and that's how he could talk to them. And I was like, oh, this ain't going to end well at all. But since then, he has worked as an assistant, been assistant head coach with Dan Quinn. He went over to the offensive side to try to get what they said you had to have in order to be a coach. Now he's the defensive coordinator again. I don't know what effect that's going to have, but he had a job for a short period of time, and it did not work out. Josh McDaniels had that job for that short period of time, was worse in terms of performance than Raheem Morris was, and use the first round pick on Tim Tebow, which we cannot forget in talking about. Right. You talking about this guy coming to get you a quarterback. That dude drafted Tim Tebow. Okay. Every year we hear about somebody wanting to give Josh McDaniels a job. You never hear anybody even like kicking the tires on Raheem Morris. And this is in a world where they make you interview a black dude and y'all only know like six of them.
That's what I don't get is why y'all can't find, like, at least bring some other people around. Like, you just keep, like, retreading the same ones where it's just token. Like, do they pay them for that? Like, I feel like you should pay them if you're not going to seriously consider them. Like, this is an opportunity. But I would say that to the point, and I mean, we can move on at any point. Yeah. Obviously, it's your show. But the point of, that really frustrates me, and I hate, frankly, hate being in the position where it feels like I have to cape for a particular coach or I have to, like, hate on another coach in this situation. Like, I hate having or feeling like I have to denigrate the hiring of Joe Judge. Like, he might be a great coach.
Yep.
Maybe. And I hate being in that situation, but you force us there and, or not you, but it, we are forced there sometimes. And just these type of things are floated. Like, Joe Judge is not a name we even know. Like, I'm not sure if he had a Wikipedia page before he got hired yesterday.
I tell you this, if you go to Wiki and look for Joe Judge, you know who's coming up.
Judge Joe Brown.
Judge Joe Brown. I don't know if that's true. Let me check now.
I'm sure it's on there. But while you look that up, I'll point out, at some point, Jason Witten's name was floated.
Yes!
Like, can you imagine if a black player was like, just, he's going to go from tight end to head coach? Like, that's something that's unrealistic. And it's just, I just, if there is anybody who still believes that the biases don't exist, which I imagine they stopped listening a long time ago if they did, if they are there, like, can you explain to me why these things don't happen? Why the black equivalent to Cliff Kingsbury hasn't been hired? Why the black equivalent to Joe Judge hasn't been hired? Like, this, why no one's like, hey, you know what? Benjamin Watson won a few Super Bowls with the Patriots. Benjamin Watson's a real good dude.
I'm going to say he's a looked-apart all-star in this.
Benjamin Watson even says all the right things publicly. Benjamin Watson is a backup tight end. You know what? Maybe we should just hire him right off the sideline. Like, it just doesn't happen. Y'all would flip out.
Yo, I understood the idea that you want to hire a dude because he was a good broadcaster. I ain't never heard of a situation where you saw that dude be a bad one. Like, Matt Millen was a good broadcaster. I saw why somebody would have thought to give him the job if they gave him 11.5 for 8 years. But, no, they, I don't know. I try not to get frustrated. I feel, and the frustration, again, I wind up having is that we do this year after year after year. We do this every single time. We wind up in the same place. And I think you made a good point about Joe Judge Brown that I don't want to knock that dude because for all I know, he could be Steve Kerr. Like, I had all kinds of questions about when they hired Steve Kerr.
Right.
And obviously that worked out well. But when they were, when Lacob was asked about, you know, so when did you get warm to this idea of hiring Steve Kerr? He's like, oh, we were playing golf.
Exactly.
And I was just like, oh, dog, man, like, what you want from me right now? You're asking for a great deal. I think there's another level, and this is part of the business that I'm in, and I imagine this happens to a degree with coaching also. It helps if your parents got money. Like, forget about just the raw nepotism of it. It helps if your parents have money. And what I mean is these quality control jobs and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
They ain't paying no money, at least as I understand it.
Nope.
You're not getting paid off that. You
got GA, grad assistants in college. Yeah.
You have to be able to take a certain vow of poverty if you don't know somebody in the game in order to make this happen. Most people are not in a position when they get out of school where they can afford to just – like, do this.
And, like, the relationships help. It's hard. Like, there are lots of people who want a job being a whatever in some program. Mm-hmm. So knowing somebody to get you in there. And then we know the history of the people who have had success. So knowing someone who knows someone to get you in there. And then also having the money to withstand the year or two where you're not going to make anything. Then withstand the 5 years where you're going to make next to nothing. Like, those are roadblocks along the way.
Yeah.
And one of the most, like, frustrating things I think it should be for Roger Goodell in the league right now is we as the undefeated, and I've been talking about it everywhere, before the season started, talked about this as the year of the black quarterback. And it is more than lived up to that.
Yep.
One black quarterback is going to hand the MVP trophy over to another black quarterback. All the best quarterbacks, particularly young quarterbacks, are black. Like, this is legitimate progress for an important position that has a ugly racial history. And, like, the NFL could be walking around trumpeting that. But, no, you got another problem where you got one black GM and no black coaches getting real hires. And it's sad because while we're not at some post-racial world as far as quarterbacks are concerned, we're definitely in a different place because I remember and this might get a little too real for everybody out there, but I remember feeling like I had to protect black quarterbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And like, and I've only been on, I haven't felt that way necessarily since I've been in the media, but like from the time I was a kid all the way till recently, I felt like if there was a black quarterback out there, I'm going to find me a way to believe in him. And I also feel like it's like the same reaction to like the OJ trial where you like, it's a terrible analogy, but it's the same thing where it's like, who cares what he's done? Like, it's a black man under pressure. I'm waiting on my OJ prize. Mm-hmm. So like, I'm finally at a point where I don't feel any urge to get up here and pretend like Jameis Winston is something that he's not.
Yo, let's talk about him for a second.
That's great.
In this regard.
I'm just happy to be there.
Yo, let's talk about him in this regard. I'm thinking about writing something on this. Maybe do it for the undefeated. But please do. But it's an interesting thing that you point out.
You can't say and then not do it.
Oh, but I can. As Raina. I do that all the time. Okay, so I agree with you. The protecting the black quarterback. And I don't know if I've ever felt like I needed to protect, except I do wind up in them situations where it'd be like, damn, man, now y'all just going too far.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't know how to talk about Tyrod Taylor. Because you know what Tyrod Taylor was? An NFL quarterback.
Yeah.
Like, he made the Pro Bowl that one year. But by and large, he's a dude in the NFL. And that's what we can call him. Except that's not how people talk about him, right? They talk about him like he's the worst quarterback who ever lived, right? You can go look at the DVOA for Buffalo and all those years while he was there, except for the last one when there was nothing around him. But they were a good offense, right? Mm-hmm. Not great necessarily, but they were a good offense. They were a better offense than they are now while he was there. But nobody will just be like, hey, man, do that quarterback. Nobody will say that. It all just winds up going to this place that's too far. And the same thing happens for coaches, because I always say every year I can make an argument for firing 20 coaches.
Mm-hmm.
If I want to fire him, I could get the lead columnist in the city to write a column about how he's starting to get shaky and get people thinking about it. And then it'll go from there. It's like a dude like Caldwell. People are like, what about Caldwell in Cleveland? I think Caldwell is a great fit for Cleveland. I think Caldwell also is a guy who doesn't get the clock right. And that's all anybody will talk about. This is the way in baseball with Dusty Baker. All anybody ever talks about is him talking about he didn't want base runners clogging the bases. Never mind all the winning he did, everything else. That one thing will be found, and then that'll be taken, and then it goes. Now, with Jameis, when you talk about black quarterbacks, hey, man, if somebody wants to make the argument that there is no more racism in America, Jameis Winston is standing right here in front of you. This dude threw 30 interceptions. This dude closed out the season with a pick six. He was the number one pick in the draft. They have not been to the playoffs with him as the quarterback. He has skeleton bones all up in the closet.
Oh,
right?
So many bones.
And people are still like, so, maybe we should keep him around.
That's the point.
What black man has ever had that situation? Like, Tyrod Taylor's over here like, what, he get to stay? Are you serious? It's white dudes out here that's looking around like, all right, Ryan Fitzpatrick. Oh, okay, but I got to go to my, all right.
Yeah, I agree. I came to this realization. Like, I just made the point that I don't feel that urge to be like, hey, why don't y'all get off of Jameis? Where I find myself on the other side. Like, I wrote in my pre-draft column last year, I was like, they should probably move on from Jameis and draft a quarterback and move on and close this chapter. And I look around and I see white people saying, well, but who they gonna get better than Jameis? And I look around, I shake my head like, what world am I living in? So while we are not in a post-racial society, like that particular point, I think it's Chris Rock who made the joke that like true equality is like having the freedom to be average.
Yep.
Like, yeah, Jameis Winston has that freedom. And of course there's no backup black quarterbacks and there's a lot of relationships and all that and that. But you know what? We are somewhere.
Yo, he the OJ it is, where it's like, he the one that got off? You know what I'm saying? Like all these people that's in jail for no reason, he the one that got off. That's what I'm looking at Jameis. Like, of all the dudes, Jacoby Brissett gotta be over there like, yo, I've been trying to play with a knee sprain. I ain't know I was gonna start this year. They trying to run me up out of here. This dude down there threw 30 touchdowns. I am the upstanding citizen.
I can't imagine. I just imagine in the Central Park Five looking at OJ. We just got to find five black quarterbacks and call them the NFL Five and have them standing around looking at Jameis. Like, what I got to do? I got to be 6'5"? What's the difference?
So Dan Orlovsky walking around here like, maybe you see Jameis. I mean, he's not really doing that, guys. Yeah. But, you know.
But,
still.
I mean, he might have a leg to stand
Everybody
on.
Got a point. He threw 30 interceptions in 2019, and he's going to be on a roster next year.
Yeah, I mean, even Jeff George had to bounce around from team to team. Jameis Winston, in my view, he's not just going to be on the roster. I think they're going to franchise him, probably, would be my guess. And they're going to trot him out there week one and say, you know what? things are different. The second year in the Arian system is when he's going to stop throwing the ball to the other jersey.
Right to him. Right to him.
Amazing. And then, like, we have what happened in the playoffs. I also find the criticism to be interesting, too, because I think there are a lot of writers and people in the media who are conscious of the way that they'll sound. So they are, which I think is fine. They're delicate about the way that they criticize black quarterbacks. But you know what I didn't hear a lot of is people talking about Josh Allen having what essentially a processing problem.
Yes. Like that never happens.
Had that been a black quarterback, yeah, we'd have been all here listening about how he can't read defenses, he makes bad decisions. Like, that's all he did. It was not an ability issue with him. He just got in the second half and looked at Deshaun Watson and said, I'm a be him. No, you not.
Let me ask you this seriously. You can't name one white quarterback for whom the rap in public has been that he's stupid.
Nah, too smart.
Or that he can't make decisions.
Josh Rosen, too smart.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, like, that's the wildest thing is no one ever has that question about ever does it come up. Well, I don't know if he can process an offense. And by the way, processing offense is not easy because I don't think I can do it.
It's quick. Yeah, like, there's a different type of intelligence, which is why, like, I think most NFL teams don't respect the Wonderlic. It's outdated. Like, there's a different type of intelligence that comes with processing quickly. And so the funny thing is I heard Deshaun Watson's quotes about the big play where he broke two tackles. And even me, I watched that play and I didn't think, man, that was some mental gymnastics. You think it's physical, but Deshaun Watson broke down from the beginning of the play, recognizing that it was zero blitz, recognizing that one of the linebackers on the other team was once on his team. So he knew the linebacker would know that DeAndre Hopkins was his outlet. So he knew he couldn't have that. So he went through all of that and he understood where the blitz was coming from and what guys were going to come free. Now at the end, breaking them tackles and making that throw is athleticism, but like we just don't account for the fact that to get to that point, it was such a mental exercise. And then we look on the other sideline and the dude rolling left, throwing jump balls to damn square bodies and double coverage. Like that dude name is DeMarco, not Quintoris Julio Jones. DeMarco. He threw it up to a square body fullback and double coverage across his body. Like that is a decision. And I'm not even going to talk about the lateral decision. Like that was something else. And then to get sacked on back-to-back plays to essentially take away your opportunity.
Running away on that one.
What you doing? Like, that is mental, if anything else, right? And no one's out here saying, like, there was some fourth quarter mental collapse.
No, here's the thing about black quarterbacks this year. And that year, the quarterback, we've talked about it a lot over here. I believe there are eight black starting quarterbacks in the NFL. Dude, four of them are left. And realize that. Look, we are not guaranteed to have a black starting quarterback in the AFC, but it's pretty damn likely, right? Yeah. It's Lamar, it's Mahomes,
Watson,
and then Tannehill.
Yeah.
In the NFC, the best quarterback over there, without question, is Russell Wilson. Like, I got Seattle coming out of the NFC, not because they're good, but I feel like they're close enough to Green Bay that I think it might come down to which team has the better quarterback. And right now, is Seattle.
If they win in Green Bay, I think that they beat San Francisco once and they were close in the second game. I have been hard on, and you and I had this conversation. Yeah. I beat you to that take because we both were looking at the numbers and watching the games, several weeks ago, like midseason, and thinking like, you know what? Seahawks aren't that good.
They have a negative point differential for the season.
So I went public with that, and Seahawks fans been killing me ever since. So I don't know if I'm rooting for a all-black NFL, all-black Super Bowl, because then the Seahawks fans really going
to
get me.
It's going to be interesting if we get the all-black Super Bowl, though.
In Miami?
Yeah, and I feel like we got to go out of our way to hype that up, man. Okay. I don't know if you've noticed over the years, man, McDonald's used to do commercials for Black History Month. You don't really see that no more. They trying to dement. No, baby. February 2020 is the Black History Month of the year of the black quarterback. Man. We are required. We're dashiki down there.
I don't think I could pull off the dashiki.
You could try.
I'll give it an effort. If you wear dashiki, is this a commitment you're making?
We get
an all-black Super Bowl. At some point, you got to wear a dashiki on TV.
Yo, you know, I just might.
I'll do it. I'll do it. I'm going to get up, going to confuse the hell out of Green.
I just got one.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I got one for Christmas. So, you know, I might have to make that work.
I'm fine with it. I've never wore dashiki because in there, at least in Baltimore, there was a connotation that the dashiki wearers was that they was going to give you the true meaning about life. And like, so since I grew up and hung out with mostly black people, if I grew up and hung out with white people, maybe I would feel the need to put on the dashiki. But if you are differentiating yourself amongst black people with the dashiki, the expectation is that you,
Okay. So you say like, if you had gone to Johns Hopkins instead of going to Maryland, you might have needed to minor in African American studies and then do the whole thing.
But yeah, but since I grew up around black people and my football team was mostly black, I felt like differentiating yourself on the black side of the black people means that you have to have the answers to everything. Because that's, in Baltimore, you see people with dashikis, they trying to preach to you, at least that was my experience, they trying to preach to you about the white devil and how we gotta unite and we gotta have our own businesses and create our own internal economy. The problem is not that the white man is oppressing us, it's that we are oppressing ourselves. Yes. That's the dashiki that I'm familiar with.
And while we at it, why is it that the black olives are in cans, but the green olives are in jars?
That's a good point.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm scared of the black olives.
Yeah, yeah, they're
fearful. People caged up.
They fearful. You being from Baltimore, let me ask you this about Lamar. Like, how big a deal is that going to be if they win the Super Bowl with Lamar Jackson?
How big a deal is it going to be? It's already an entirely enormous deal. So, like, I live in D.C. now, so I don't get to Baltimore too often, but I'm close enough, friends and family. And Lonnae O'Neal with the Undefeated wrote a piece about what Lamar means to the black fans in Baltimore. And it reminds me, frankly, of RG3 in D.C. It's like, the Washington franchise is one that people don't really care about in Washington to that degree anymore, which is damning to say. But for that 1 year, people was all the way in. The whole city. And both of those cities are getting more white with gentrification, whatever. But the heart of both of those cities are still quite black. And there's something to be said, particularly with Lamar Jackson in Baltimore, because he's better than RG3. And also because the type of blackness that he represents.
There we go.
That, like, there is no one type of blackness, but there is a type of blackness that tends to not get celebrated or not be allowed to be in the front of things and whose voices we don't want to hear. So it feels fantastic.
Yo, look, Lamar got braids. RG3 got braids.
And that's where the similarity
is. But it ain't, but it don't mean the same thing. Yeah. Right. Like we look at Robert Griffin and we looked at his braids and we like, damn dog, you still got braids? Right? We look at Lamar and be like, yo, that's just dude with braids. You know, like it's a whole nother animal that's there. And also Robert did so much to try to say everything right.
Right.
You know, he worked like, in a different way than Russell Wilson, who was a machine at those things. But Robert obviously has clearly tried to present himself in a way that made him acceptable to some people. I don't even know how conscious it was for him. I think that's just where he grew up, around the military base and all that stuff. That was just what it was. Lamar, however, the most interesting thing in Baltimore is that the Ravens were like, let's just talk however it is that you talk.
They
right?
lean in on it. You follow this, like I've been following their social media since I was a player there. The social media has changed. Like the way the social media frames things and the music that they choose and all that stuff, like they are leaning in.
Yeah, this is who he is.
This is what we got. We're going to build the offense around him. We also going to build everything else around him. Like I feel like they should have a hoodie day at the office where everybody from the team president, Dick Cass, all the way down to the whoever, the people who sweep up. Yeah. Like y'all need to come in and skinny jeans and hoodies.
Yes.
So those wild dog hoodies, the Lamar Jackson era hoodies or something, because It's a thing to the point where people around the city talking about big trust. You don't even know what it means. Throwing up hand signals. Like, everybody is in on this in the Ravens organization and all of Baltimore, frankly, the state of Maryland.
Yeah, I'm curious how it's going
to... My son loves Lamar Jackson.
I'm curious how it's going to evolve with him because he's going to grow. He's going to get better. Like, because I do think that he's not doing anything wrong per se, but he could present better, right? I don't even mean cleaner or anything like that. I just mean better, like speaking up, projecting your voice, like with a confidence that he doesn't currently have.
I mean, I'm with you. Be louder. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
I want him to speak with the same accent, same references. And in the piece that I referenced that Lonnae wrote, one of the things that stood out was like, you brought up the braids, but before the braids, they had, the black kids that she talked to were excited about the fact that he had a cruddy, which I didn't know what it was, but it's like essentially like the popular hairstyle is like the Like where you are not necessarily trying to hide your naps.
Where you got, you're just like,
yeah, apparently the kids in Baltimore at least called it a cruddy. And it was like, you showed up to your opening press conference with a cruddy and a green suit and all that. It was like that. They don't get much blacker than that. Yeah. And he has not had to conform in any way. And that, it makes me happy and proud. Yeah.
Well, like we've seen, but I mentioned that, like Cam Newton, for example, mm-hmm. where he has gotten worlds better at handling these things when he first got in. But part of why that was, he had Jerry Richardson and everybody else telling him that he needed to do it a certain way. You got Jerry Richardson recommended that he meet with the Fox News guy in order to learn how to talk about these social issues. Like, they were always so afraid. And I say good for Cam, though, because I say I do think he handles those situations better now, right? Like, you are the face of a franchise, that's and I think he presents himself very well in that way. With Lamar, like, I present his win.
That's a good point.
I present E-dubs.
If them dubs stop coming, I guarantee you,
Ooh, the Ravens'
social media would change. People would change the way we talk about them. But, like, my experience with the Bisciotti family is they aren't the types, or they weren't the types when I was there, to be overly concerned. And they had Joe Flacco at the point. Joe Flacco was going to present the way Joe Flacco presents, which most people are comfortable with. But on the defensive side of the ball, like, they wasn't trying to, I guess Ray kind of censored himself to some degree considering his early career stuff. Mm-hmm. But Ed was Ed, but they was never, and Suggs, like, had his myriad issues, but it was never something about, you got to be this certain way. I think that the Baltimore franchise, in part because of Ozzie Newsome being the only GM that they've ever had and possibly the best GM, not possibly, I believe him to be the best GM in the history of the league. Like he was one who leaned into like, be you, do what you do. And we going to support you as long as them wins keep coming.
Ozzie, I love this. I got one last thing I'm going to do before I roll out. Lamar. That was basically his last act as general manager. I'm leaving y'all this boy with these plats. I'm dropping him off in a basket on the porch and I'm out.
The funny thing is, like, I wrote a piece on Ozzie last season, early in the season, about how he wasn't getting, just about his career and how he's the greatest GM, blah, blah, blah. And I talked to him a few different times, and Ozzie Newsome from Mississippi, and talking to him, you get all the old black man vibes. And I reference Chris Rock a lot. We all do, because Chris Rock is fantastic and very prescient when it comes to issues of race. But where you think about, there's a level of conformity.
Yes.
That comes expectation, where I was talking to Ozzie Newsome and I'm all charged up. And Ozzie is just like controlled about everything. And to a point where I didn't understand it. I was like, you grew up in Mississippi. You know what all this means. You know where how far we've traveled, and you represent some of this travel. And like, he was critical of the NFL, but he was tepid. And it reminds me somewhat, frankly, of like some of the conversations that I had with Stephen A. And I don't mean this to be critical in any way, where it's like, it's the, you gotta be twice as good.
Mm-hmm.
It's that, which like, I understand, and I tell my three kids that too. But I also feel like publicly, rather than say that, I would say like, nah, y'all gotta be better.
Yes.
And that's what the difference is. And Stephen A would argue with me, say, no, say both. Which is.
I'd love to talk to Ozzie about Bear Bryant.
Yeah, so he loves him.
Yeah, he played. And the thing about Bryant that's interesting, I was reading up on this over Christmas for some reason. Once they finally, after the Sam Bam Cunningham game, and they'd already gotten that started, but after, happened, Alabama didn't wait to get the black dudes in. They were like, oh, that's what we doing now?
Yeah.
As many as they'll let me have.
Yeah, come through the back door if you have to, but as long as his helmet and shoulder pads fit. Yeah.
I
talked to Ozzie about that, and I had to rewrite part of my piece because the second time I talked to him is when we started talking to Bear Bryant stuff, and I felt like my characterization of Bear Bryant was going to be fair, but it was going to be critical in certain places. And there was no place for that given the quotes that he gave me. Like, he loved Bear Bryant and saw Bear Bryant as probably the chief reason for a lot of his success, which, like, even more than his dad, like, he talked about his mom sacrificing to get him to practices and all that stuff growing up. It talks about her showing him hard work and all that. But, like, I don't want to go too far because I'm sure his father meant a lot of things, but in his career, he points to the lessons he learned from Bear Bryant, which I mean, frankly shocked me, as I expected a black dude from Mississippi to like have some issue. Like Bear Bryant was on the wrong side of a lot of stuff.
Yeah, but let me tell you something though. You never know who the white dude is that's going to get it done. Like, I think that's a fascinating lesson for people to keep in mind. Like, knowing what we knew historically about Lyndon Johnson, you don't think Lyndon Johnson going to be the guy to push through the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Let's go to the NFL, for example. And I, you know, obviously I have some problems as it relates to race and the way that Daniel Snyder runs his football team with the name of it. They are on their third black quarterback, and he just turned the whole operation over to the Latin dude.
Yeah.
You never know who the person is going to be that's going to be the one to act right.
Yeah. I was shocked when and Hugh Jackson is not a coach that I would say is like a good coach. But when I remember when the Browns hired Hugh Jackson, they had Sashi Brown. They had an offensive and defensive coordinator that was black. Like the Browns were so brown. And like that was one of those situations where I was like, I want to root for the Browns in part just because of this. They failed miserably because they weren't trying to succeed. But that was like, I was super critical of the Dolphins early in the season. But part of the reason why I was very critical of the Dolphins because I saw what happened with the Browns.
Yeah.
When it's tank time,
we're going
to go ahead. Yeah. Draw the key. You got the keys to this. Smash it into whatever you want. But when it's time to get serious, we're going to run you out of there.
Yes.
So like, I expected that to happen to Chris Greer and to Flores, but Brian Flores and Chris Greer, no better than me, obviously, they came out here and was like, nah, y'all ain't gonna do that. We're not gonna win the Super Bowl, but we're gonna make sure that when it's time to turn this roster over, we've done what we have to do to prove to you, or at least embarrass you. It doesn't mean they're not gonna do it. You're gonna be ashamed if Stephen Ross, who fancies himself a champion of social justice issues.
Yep.
If Stephen Ross decides when it's time to turn this over to hire a white coach, it's going to be real hard to justify that given what they've done with this depleted roster.
Yeah, no, this whole thing is just random, man. All this race stuff is just like John Elway, the guy who writes letters on company letterhead supporting Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, is also the dude that hired Vance Joseph.
Yep.
And please understand this. If there were any way in the 2011 draft for him to take Cam Newton, he would have done it. You never know, man. It's Mike Brown. He's the guy that kept Marvin Lewis for 17 years.
Facts.
Me and Mike Brown ain't voting the same on nothing. Nothing at all.
I wonder, like, the Marvin Lewis, so that's another guy where I have to check my own personal biases because I find myself saying that I like Marvin Lewis and I think Marvin Lewis should be considered for some of these jobs. And the reaction I get from most people is like, that's just ridiculous. And I try to find out, like, am I being unfair? Is this my own bias, like looking for a black dude? But like, I feel like the justification for that is difficult. I understand his playoff success is what it is, but the context matters to me.
Yeah. You go win a game with Andy Dalton.
Yeah.
With Mike Brown. Yeah. Like, in terms, like winning in spite of ownership. As I said, if you have any team that you think the coach need to win in spite of ownership.
They don't have real scouts. They only scout in the Ohio and Big Ten area because it's to save them money. Now, maybe that's changed, but at least 5 years ago, that was true. Under Marvin Lewis, that was absolutely true. And they managed to, I guess the evaluation is that they drafted well in part because they kept all their players, but they probably also drafted well they kept their players because who else they gonna get? They don't know who's good around the league because they don't pay enough scouts to find out.
And that's how they also wind up with the knucklehead coalition because they come cheap.
Oh yeah, that's another thing. Yeah, where they had all those guys who were getting in trouble, and it's part because Marvin Lewis like, man, I can't worry about what you gonna do off the field. If you can play on the field, I'ma find a way because we ain't gonna never get another player as talented as you because we're not invested in scouting. And like to be able to do that in the division with the Ravens and the Steelers who are never bad. Like that is an impressive thing. One of my best friends who I had drinks with last week in New York, one of my best friends from business school used to talk about how he should get a better grade than everybody else. Like super smart guy, but he didn't test as well as everybody else or whatever, or participate in class as well. But he was like, I should get a better grade because of the distance I traveled. Cause I didn't show up to no classes. I didn't take no notes. But the night before, I got in here and I got around slightly above average. So like, people should acknowledge that. And I think that same, he's a Sri Lankan dude. So maybe he understands a little bit, but I think that same, equation should apply to Marvin Lewis. Like he ain't win no Super Bowls, but look around.
Yeah. But the counterpoint on Marvin also is Marvin did get a second chance. It was just with Cincinnati, because they turned that whole thing over after the 2010 season. Yeah. Then when they drafted AJ Green, they drafted Andy Dalton. I mean, that's the beginning of that.
Maybe I'm wrong here. Maybe I need to fall back on defending Marvin.
Oh, no.
This is my own personal
bias. I always say he got the second chance there, but the idea that Marvin Lewis is somehow this terrible coach, they went 2-14. You think that team would have gone 2-14 this year with Marvin Lewis? Because I don't.
Was he 0-7 in the playoffs?
Yeah.
Do the Bengals have seven playoffs? I know they went to the Super Bowl that one year. They lost.
They have won one playoff game since that Super Bowl. Literally one since that Super Bowl. And again, go look up Andy Dalton's numbers in the postseason, and you tell me who it was. And basically, every team they played was like, "All right, Andy Dalton, you got this." And he was like, "No, I don't." Carson Palmer getting his ACL torn, yep, that first playoff game that they played in that first run. Like, he is not someone who should be laughed out of the building for the idea of hiring him.
And Carson Palmer, the organization was so bad.
He quit.
Carson Palmer was like, "No, I'm good.
He quit.
I'm done with this. If y'all want to trade me, I'll play this out and go ahead and scoop up the rest of these millions. But you know what I'm not going to do is come back here for another season."
This has been fun.
It always is.
Dominique Foxworth.
I love it.
Check him out at The Undefeated. Nice watch.
Appreciate it.
Second nicest watch at the table.
You got me beat. I told you. I didn't pick it out.
Simply a matter of taste.
You too flashy. Just like a, never mind.
That's right. That's right. But ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Again, thanks to Dominique Foxworth. Also, thanks to our sponsor, Hims. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. And I'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.